Talk to us now and go to the TNT Radio Interactive Live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT. Welcome to the Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And my guest today is Pelle Neruut, and we're talking about the, I would be safe to say, the murder of Olaf, of Dag Hammarskjöld. But why is this not just another conspiracy theory? We have an ongoing United Nations investigation into it. It's ongoing since decades, really, but now it has culminized once again. Please, can you give us a little bit outline of the facts? Why aren't there only reasons, but what are the facts that we know about why this, and what has been declined for a long time to be known by the public?
Well, there were three reports in the in 1961, one by the Rhodesian Board of, two from Rhodesia, and one from the United Nations. And the Rhodesian one, Rhodesia is the former British colony that on which Hammarskjöld died. That's where the peace negotiations were supposed to take place. And the plane crashed on just inside Rhodesian territory. And the Rhodesians said it was an accident. The UN was ambivalent and left open the possibility of having more, that it wasn't an accident. The big change, it happened in 2011 when there was a book by a scholar called Susan Williams called Who Killed Hammarskjöld, where she brought up a lot of the witness testimonies from Africans who'd been ignored on the night of the crash, which described various things. Some of them described planes taking off from the Rhodesian-owned airfield on which Hammarskjöld was about to land. Some of them described one or sometimes two planes in the sky in addition to Hammarskjöld's DC-6, who either fired on or dropped something that could be a projectile or a missile or something. And crucially, there was several testimonies about a crew of two or three Land Rovers turning up after the crash in the bush and setting fire to a plane wreck and driving off again. And one witness talked about, he was a young British Rhodesian musician, a sort of pop musician, one of the early pop musicians traveling between, and he was on his motorbike, and he saw this, and he said that he was stopped by someone with a South African accent saying, "Well, if you don't leave now, we'll shoot you." And these various testimonies were ignored initially as the Rhodesians were pushing very heavily for a controlled flight into terrain, perhaps caused by the unfamiliarity of the Swedish pilot of this terrain, or maybe he'd mistaken the airport, which was called Ndola, for one called Njili, which was Leopoldville's airport, and that he couldn't see the runway or something. But the and Susan Williams also looked at some of the forensic evidence that showed that the bullets near the wreckage came from were quite old bullets, and there were too many types of bullets to be accounted for by Hammarskjöld's bodyguards. And there was also something very strange that the body of the two French speakers on board were found in the cockpit. One was a secretary and the other one was an official. And they would normally be found in the cockpit. And one of the rumors that she explored was the possibility that a mercenary pilot who was ultimately supported by the British, but through possibly the Katangan government, had tried to stop the aeroplane or force the aeroplane to land in an airport that was allied to the rebels and kind of speak Hammarskjöld to his senses or issue some other threat, before which they then started firing on the plane. And if they spoke French, only French, they'd have to have the two French speakers on board in the cockpit. And there was this very strange thing that Hammarskjöld was found with the Ace of Spades in his collar. And the Ace of Spades is the mercenary or traditional CIA symbol of death. And Hammarskjöld's body was sitting upright or in a against a, what's it called, an anthill. And he was the only person whose body hadn't been burnt almost beyond recognition. So it's very unlikely that he'd been pushed out of the or pushed out of the wreckage by the crash. What much more likely was that after the initial crash, the Hammarskjöld's body was pulled out, and then the rest of the wreckage was shot up or set up light by the cleanup crew, if you like, or the mercenaries who came to make sure that the people were dead and to take Hammarskjöld's body out to out of some respect for the man or something, or maybe because they wanted to show to the world that he actually was dead. And the these various accounts, along with an account that surfaced in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the 1990s in South Africa, where they were digging through all the old security service archives, various documentation that seemed to prove that South African intelligence had been involved in the death. And she made a lot of this, and it was such a compellingly woven together that it, the UN decided on the support of the Swedish government to set up an inquiry that started reporting every 2 years on progress in the various UN member states and finding a solution to Hammarskjöld. So this commission, which issued its first report, I think, in 2015, and then 2017, then 2019, and now in 2022, appointed an independent investigator in each country which had an interest and had the possibility of being involved in Hammarskjöld case. And every 2 years or so, he took in, this guy Chandra Othman, took in all the info from the various rapporteurs, if you like. And the results have been mixed because some people say that he's just a cover. I mean, this is an official report, and it's quite informative. I mean, it has a lot of the, it's and quite skeptical. But what's really telling is the fact that he's had almost no cooperation from the British or the Americans. And the cover-up is almost, the fact of the cover-up is almost more interesting in than the crash itself, in the sense that you can get really buried in all these forensic details about what plane could have been the candidate. I mean, some people say it was a propeller plane, other people say it was a jet plane, that how many pilots there were, what language they were speaking, what was their possible route in approaching the Hammarskjöld plane. And I know from investigating Palma is that there's so many sprawling trails. I mean, you can write many, many books on this, and everybody gets confused and but doesn't believe anything in these so-called conspiracy theory. But let's narrow down on this. If the British had 18 planes parked in the Rhodesian tarmac, because it's the Royal Rhodesian Air Force, and they were supposed to escort Hammarskjöld to the Ndola airport, and they didn't do that. The Americans had two DC-3s and one the air attaché for Southern Africa was on board, and they also had monitoring equipment. They also had hacked into the Hammarskjöld team's encryption machine. And MI6 also had tapped or had a link to the cable between that ran between Katanga and Rhodesia, which was the only outside link, so that all communications between the UN base in Katanga and the outside world, as well as Katangan government communications, MI6 had total awareness of. And the Americans had NSA listening bases, which listened to all conversations taking place of the ether in Africa that night. And we've got two testimonies, one from a guy called Paul Abrams, and I think the other from a guy called Charles Southall. And they reported hearing a mercenary pilot saying, we can see the plane, we're going to shoot now. And these two guys maintained this for decades, that they'd heard a mercenary somebody was approaching the plane, and they say that they were going to shoot. There's some discrepancy in their reports. One of them said, I think Abrams said they were speaking in English, and another guy said Southall said they were speaking in French. So that's the problem. When you get into this level of granular detail, accounts will differ, and people get very confused, and they say, well, if they can't both be telling the truth, so maybe they've both made it up. But just to get back to the big story, there was multiple surveillance from multiple sources from both the British and Americans. The British had a tower recording as well. Dola was one of the most modern airports in Africa. None of these notes or recordings or transcripts of the recordings have been provided either to the initial inquiries or to the Othman inquiry, who had a UN authorization to pursue this. This old question, if they haven't got anything to hide, why are they not releasing them? Because basically, our knowledge of the last few minutes of Hammarskjöld's life is guesswork. But we know that there are recordings of the last conversation with the control tower and possibly other planes. So if they haven't revealed those things, why do they not want to contribute to the solution of this event, you know? So the latest Othman report is more... Some people, I've got a few friends who are also investigating this. They say, well, he's just a cover-up man. He doesn't want to blame the United States, and he doesn't want to get dug into this. He's just a UN man, and the UN is toothless. I think it's actually, when you read through the diplomatic language, he's actually quite sharp. And I'm quite surprised that the Russians haven't made anything out of it, because they could use their it's a big sledgehammer in their arsenal in the Cold War that's happening now. So it came out in November, I think. And I don't think, so it's basically saying, summarizing a 100-page report or whatever in a few sentences, we're still waiting for more information from the British and Americans. We know that they've got cockpit recordings, and we know that they've tapped they recorded everything that's going on. Why do they not release this information? We're waiting. And then Othman called for the appointment, I think, or was it Gutierrez, the UN Secretary General, in his introduction, called for continued investigation into this area. So the story is that all these testimonies from black charcoal. A charcoaler is somebody who walks around in the bush around Nadola and builds charcoal kilns to burn for using charcoal. And they were often working nights, and they'd be sitting there tending to the fires. And they are the ones who describe these multiple planes above. But my hesitation in saying that it was definitely an aerial attack is that some of the surveys, even by independent researchers, cannot prove that the plane was riddled with bullets. And I think some of the holes that they pointed to proved to be just sort of the holes that crop up in a plane anyway, you know, when you're kind of flying around. They were just the holes from bolts, and not produced by gunfire. And once you start arguing on that micro level, you'll get all these various interpretations. When we're going to do our projects, we're going to try and get an interview with the Secretary General, or at least with Othman, to get him to say that this is our main angle of attack, is to ask the British and Americans to produce the evidence that we know that they've got, And if they haven't produced it, why? What is their explanation? I think the what happened with the our rival project, which was a very good documentary film called Cold Case Hammerfell, came out 3 years ago and had very high production values. And it was sponsored by the Scandinavian various film companies. And they produced single-mindedly this MI6 trail. There were these faxes or telexes that had that talked quite openly about a CIA MI6 operation to sabotage Hammerfell's plane by putting a bomb in the hold. And then there was this weird... and it was called the SIMAR, South African Institute of Maritime Research, which was run by a weird guy called Wilson, I think. And I think that organization basically existed, but I think it was not an assassination organization. It was basically a mercenary recruitment organization for MI6, for bushfire wars in the 1980s and 1990s. And I think it was a false trail planted by MI6 in the 1990s. Just when the conversations about Hammerfell's death started again. It was a false trail that pointed out the perpetrators, but with a line of evidence that actually didn't work out, because I don't think there's no evidence that the plane was sabotaged with a bomb. So this standard thing, once you follow a trail and then that particular trail doesn't work out, and that dismisses that whole line of inquiry. So people say,
yeah, oh, we have to take another break, Pelle. Yeah. Let's get back to that. But let's when we get back, let's don't forget that the major thing is that we know that there is knowledge, and there was kind of a hustle between a guy from the United States side, and they were pulling back and forth on a file that was supposed to be handed over, and then in the last second they decided not to hand it over. So we know that the British and American intelligence services have knowledge about that we have not seen yet, that the investigation from the United Nations has not seen it, and that yet again we have something like, it's called a conspiracy theory, when everybody knows that there must be conspiracy, because after all these years, since 1960, we don't know really what happened. But back after the advertisement.
TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Do you think I'll ever get tired of coming on and saying, we were right, they were wrong, we told you so? Yeah, no, I'm never going to get tired of that. But guess what? I get to say it again today. Because guess what? We were right. They were wrong. Twitter censored Donald Trump and political candidates in advance of the 2020 election. That's called election tampering, at the very least. It's an in-kind donation to those Democrat campaigns. Where is the Federal Election Commission on this? So what's the fair market value of letting Democrats have the floor, not letting Republicans speak? What is the fair market value of allowing one political candidate to be able to reach voters, but not his or her opponent? Seems to me the value is self-evident. But you can get an economist to actually put a dollar value on that.
The Reckoning with Timothy Shea on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
When it comes to making plans, you are the best. What about those round trips that you plan in advance, which are perfect on your way there and perfect on your way back? Or those meetings with friends for which you make a group chat 3 months before so that nobody or anything is missing? Or your daughter's first birthday party. You planned it with such dedication that instead of the first, it felt like our 15th. The same way you plan each detail for those moments. Start planning to protect you and your loved ones from a natural disaster. Sign up for local weather and emergency alerts. Prepare an emergency kit and make a family communications plan. Protecting your family is the best plan you can make. Get started at ready.gov/plan.
Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
This is the Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And I discuss the Dag Hammarskjöld murder with Pelle Nyroth. And Pelle, isn't that, how do you feel about it, that after 1960, United Nations politely asks if they are allowed to see the evidence that the Americans and the British are hiding, and maybe also the South Africans still are hiding. We don't know what else is in the hiding. And then officially, we still talk about conspiracy theories about this, because the evidence had piled up over the decades that this is a very strange case. And it's like many of the, I would say, the Swedish investigations. If you go into Estonia, if you go into the submarine case, if you go into the Palme murder, if you go into the Dag Hammarskjöld murder, even the Folke Bernadotte murder, where that guy was killed by the Stern gang, which included Itzhak Shamir, the later president of Israel, who killed Folke Bernadotte. That is possible. So these things happen. What is your feeling about it when you hear that these things are possible and they're not, you know, it's difficult to make a documentary about it. We discussed the documentary from Mats Brügger, Cold Case Hammarskjöld, which on the one hand is very good, but you see there the point is that they say we have the Belgian pilot, a Belgian RAF mercenary pilot who flew for the Katanga side, and he was named as the guy who pulled the trigger. But of course, the guy who pulled the trigger was not the one who gave the order to kill Hammarskjöld. And maybe we'll get into that. So what do we know about the real reason why Hammarskjöld had to be dead, why he had to be killed, and what is your take on this decades of non-existing investigation not coming to an end?
Well, I mean, it's frustrating that a lot of the things that we call conspiracy theory is, the word conspiracy theory is just used as a way to cover things up. I mean, conspiracy theories do exist in the sense of conspiracy. I take the word conspiracy theory to mean something that's completely crazy, that's been refuted many times by all the best experts in the subject, but still lives its own life because it's a fairy story that's so compelling for people with weak minds that the theory lives on. But we know that governments assassinate people. I mean, it's the Church Committee in 1975 showed it, if nothing else. You just have to buy any number of books, history books, that know, we know that the US and the UK carry out coups, pay off students, conduct color revolutions, have assassination squads. And you've even got the Israelis, who are franker than most people, even admit it on the record in that book called by Ronan Bergman, I think. It's only conspiracy theory because the primary filter for the average person is the daily newspapers and the big government broadcasting companies like the BBC or ZDF or whatever, and they don't talk about it. So I think the word conspiracy theory is a devilish phrase because the users of that phrase are saying, I'm not interested in the evidence because I've already decided that by calling you a conspiracy theorist, I have a superior intellect and you have nothing to say on this subject. Whereas in fact, all these claims about assassinations and strange things going on have to be taken on a case-by-case basis. I mean, I don't think that the Earth is flat. I do think global warming is happening. I don't think that Kennedy was killed by Lee Harvey Oswald, that the Hammarskjöld was killed in an air crash. You know, I don't believe in 5G, but I'm very skeptical of vaccines, but not as skeptical as some people. Intelligent people ought to be skeptical of all the evidence and read from many sources. And I think unfortunate thing is that most people are not very intelligent. And most people, even if they are intelligent, don't have the time because they have families to raise and jobs to go to. So they just watch the headlines and the news. And those are very heavily curated. But we know that books have been written about this. Again, you just have to dig into your Amazon Kindle bookstore about, for instance, Operation Mockingbird, which is the very close liaison that the intelligence agencies have with the newsrooms, because propaganda is half of what intelligence agencies do. I mean, if you could defeat somebody by political propaganda, you don't need to invade them, you know. That's not to say that the Chinese and the Russians do many bad things. I'm quite open to I think all states do. But those of us working on the opposite side, we just want to counteract this enormous tsunami of propaganda, just saying that the one side does it when everybody does it. It's like a barroom fight when you only see one guy throwing punches. If you don't see the other guy throwing the punches first, then you think the first guy is the aggressor, when in fact maybe he's the defensive guy. So it gets me very annoyed, because I think that without getting to the roots of these things that the average idiot calls a conspiracy theory, we won't get to any kind of morally just solution to world politics, because if the Western intelligence agencies do these things with impunity and the other guy hits back, then what happens is world opinion labels them the tyrant. And we have two different competing narratives. One guy, the opponent du jour of Western demonization, thinks he's fighting a just battle because he sees the whole story, or at least I guess it's propagandistic as well, but he sees another story where it's the West started it, whereas the West has only fed the story is that this guy's coming out of nowhere and doing bad things, you know? So we see that in the Ukraine conflict. But I mean, I think that what we need is some kind of opening of the barriers, some kind of realization, some event that could prove to the average dumbo in the West, you know, that the world's most politically illiterate population. And I mean, none of the intelligence in Turkey or Indonesia or India or Brazil, they know that the Western population are being deceived nonstop. You know, they think they don't respect us at all, you know. But what the Western population needs is something they call that confidently was a conspiracy theory, was an actual event that happened. And then they need to be taught that some things, yes, are conspiracy theories, but some things aren't. And I mean, I as a science journalist and I train in science, it's just things that are incredibly implausible, like the Earth is flat, say. I mean, that would require so many adjustments to our understanding of the world, so many things to be deceived, us be deceived all the time, that is extremely unlikely. But to assassinate someone is not beyond the beyond scientific probability, you know. So all you need is to point a gun at someone's head. I mean, that's the easiest thing in the world. And the conspiracy theory says, oh, when you see the Earth is flat from when you see the Earth is round from the spacecraft, that's because somebody's designed CGI for us, and they staged the moon landings on a Hollywood stage, and then they've got millions of people to lie to us about this, you know. So everything tells me that the Earth is round, but it's quite easy to kill someone. It's seen as an easy way to world solutions. And put it this way, I mean, the West probably rightly accuses the Russians of assassinating people, and they do, yeah? But they're not the only ones assassinating people. And so if we realize that the West had a hand in assassinating sort of the secular pope of the atomic age, Hammarskjöld, a man who sought world peace, then maybe they'll take a step back and realize that we're not always the good guys, you know. And I think when you looking, for instance, I think that maybe there's an argument to be made that, for instance, Milosevic, the Serbian leader, was killed, assassinated, or poisoned. But with these guys, you can always say, well, you know, they come from dodgy countries, and they were dictators anyway. They were tyrants or whatever. But, and you have this with Palmer as well as with Hammarskjöld. These were leaders. Palmer was the leader of a highly successful democratic country, which was an ally of the West. It was a Western democracy. And if you kill this leader, who are you? I mean, you're not killing a tyrant. And the same with Hammarskjöld. Hammarskjöld was a man devoted to peace and was seen by some people as a symbol for a better world, you know. And if he was killed, then they were really the bad guys. And part of our project goes further than the current books and films that are out there about Hammerfrill is that there seems to be a disarmament proposals going on between Khrushchev and Kennedy that went further in promoting and in disarming the great powers and in promoting a kind of UN as a more powerful solution to political conflict. And those arguments were at a very early stage, but I can't but think that the calculations of those who wanted to kill him wanted to forestall or prevent this major boost in Hammerfrill's influence that was coming his way. So in some ways, it could have been a turning point in the world. And I don't know how much all the bad guys were in. We're playing with only half of them. It's like a jigsaw puzzle where we only have half the jigsaw. And many of those pieces are in, or at least some of the pieces are in those recordings that we are not allowed to take this to see. And why is it that we can't put pressure? I mean, why can't Sweden, as a condition of its membership of NATO, say, well, okay, if you release these recordings, we'll join NATO? Why can't Gutierrez? I mean, Hammarskjöld is the most important leader that the United Nations ever had. He's the librarian at the UN is still named after him. And if you talk to people at the UN, he's still the guy they look up to and want to emulate when they start their careers. There's a Hammarskjöld Plaza as well in New York. And the whole architecture of the place in the interior, if you've been there, it's beautiful. It's like a frozen interior of the 1950s modernism, you know, like that architect Saarinen, who designed the TWA terminal at JFK. It's that more optimistic world where modern architecture, modern jazz, modern art seem to sort of all lead to a better world and a more progressive world than the World War II that we'd just come out of, you know, of competing nationalism and colonialism and so on. So all these guys who work at the UN today, and they're not doing very much because the UN is pretty neutralized, must have. Hammarskjöld is one of the central characters in their pantheon of heroes. Why are they not putting pressure? What does Gutierrez say to Biden? Okay, so you're releasing the JFK papers. Why are you not releasing the papers on Hammarskjöld? So I would like to see much more indignation. But of course, I mean, on your radio show and your channel, you know that these things never, they can almost reach the surface, but they never quite break the surface. So intelligent people who go beyond the mainstream, we could talk about it as much as we like, but it never becomes an issue, you know? What was your other question?
I would like to get into that once again, because for me it is like, if you have John F. Kennedy and if you have Dag Hammarskjöld, I happen to have a friend of mine, the family called their son Dag after Dag Hammarskjöld when he was murdered. That was the birth year of the boy. And that was the importance that he had in Germany. He was kind of, as you said, something like the Pope. I would like to, there's a quote from, again, John F. Kennedy, who said, "I realize now that in comparison to him, I am a small man. He was the greatest statesman of our century." That is John F. Kennedy and Dag Hammarskjöld. And then you see that what my question really that I have internally is, what is so damn wrong with the West that it kills its best people? That being an honest guy, somebody, you know, Dag Hammarskjöld is somebody you could even wish to be for a short time a dictator because you could trust him. It is a very, very strange person. It is like a very capable, very honest, very poetic person even. In that situation, it is like a dream come true. And as you said, this was the promise of the West in the 60s. And what is so wrong with this culture that it kills its best people? This is what comes to my mind. And then if you talk about it, that you are diminished to that your existence might be, that it is a third rail issue. You don't talk about it. You better don't talk about it if you don't want into to get into trouble. And if you do, then you end in the wilderness of mirrors where you get nowhere. So I think it's in a way the situation is an explanation that something is extremely wrong with our system, that it is possible that these things happen, that it's not possible what it should be, because democracy is a repair shop, a constant repair shop, that we get to something else, but we are stuck in this area. Will people will have something on History Channel, and it's the mystery of the Hammarskjöld murder, and we are still after 1961, we are not further in explaining and knowing who did it, why. And not even that there is a discussion, that they can have report after report after report and said, you don't give us the truth, and nothing happens. I think it's extremely frustrating.
Well, the previous president, Truman, said he was an old man by the time of 61 came around. Were you born in 61? Anyway, he said, gentlemen, he told the press, Hammarskjöld was about to achieve great things when they killed him. Note, when they killed him. And I guess as an ex-president, he might have had privileged information, or he had inside contacts who told him. He said that a few days after the crash. I think that, I guess what he proposed, what was in the air, if you look at these disarmament talks that were going on and which died, I think Kennedy was stopped in his stride by Hammarskjöld's death. His wingman was a portent, an omen of what did happen to him 2 years later. You know, first they take out Hammarskjöld, and then they take out... Hammarskjöld was the first of the big assassinations of the 60s, you know. First Hammarskjöld, and then came Kennedy, then came Martin Luther King, then came Robert Kennedy. And Americans tend to just think of the latter three, but Hammarskjöld was the first. And, you know, maybe Kennedy thought he was vulnerable after that, but these big disarmament talks, and they were going to solve the Berlin crisis by demilitarizing Germany, actually, both East and West, and put the UN in Berlin and turn Berlin into this Vatican City of peace. That was in the air just the week before Hammarskjöld. It was Kennedy's suggestion. And I think part of the reason why Hammarskjöld went down to broker peace was that he knew he was going to be called on to represent in Berlin. And if he couldn't even broker peace in a bloody African country, I mean, how was he going to do it between East and West, you know? So all these things were in the air. There's this disarmament treaty that was signed on the 20th of September, the day after Hammarskjöld died. And that, we never hear about it, but it was one of the biggest moves in disarmament until Gorbachev and Reagan, Reykjavik in 1986. But it's just now a footnote in history. So, the Russians and the Americans had to get on the same side. And I think part of what Hammarskjöld was basically doing when he went down to broker peace was that he was going to neutralize Katanga, which was a symbol of colonialism and white power, if you like, of America, British and French power, and Belgian power. And by doing that, he was going to appease the Soviets enough to bring the Soviets on board in a much bigger project of disarmament. And I think the British and the French saw him as being an agent there of the Soviets. And I also think that, and maybe they wanted to get back at Kennedy, you know, and maybe in a world where you had a more powerful UN and the UN was kind of running trusteeships over the newly independent countries, and maybe if there's a UN army and disarmament all around, the British and the French felt that the real power was anyway going to be with the superpowers. So this brave.
We have to take another break, Pelle, for advertisement, but let's get back to this proposal, because at that time there was... especially then after the Cuban Missile Crisis, there's peace in the air, because Kennedy and Khrushchev understood that they could talk, that there was much more possible, and that That is really all these things were killed to an end. But first advertisement, let's get back to that.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
The big news is what's coming to the United States Christmas week. Now, in the old days, something like this would probably be looked upon as, okay, we've got to put up with this. Now, though, it is really going to impact travel. It's going to be impacting plane flights. We are talking about the entire Arctic dumping in to the heartland of the United States, December 20 through 25th. With it, probably a widespread blizzard-like storm from Nebraska through the Midwest and into the Appalachians. Along the East Coast, it's likely to turn to rain and then a flash freeze after as it gets very, very cold. The question is, how much disruption is this going to cause? Because what's happening is it's going to get so cold in Texas. We're expecting temperatures to the teens into Houston, single digits in Dallas. No, that's not as bad as February 21, but it's bad for around this time of the year. How much disruption is that going to cause in the energy markets? And that is yet to be determined. This is TNT Weather and Climate Watchdog. I know, usually I'm Climate and Weather Watchdog, but I keep getting those two dogs mixed up. Asking you to enjoy the weather, it's the only weather you got.
Imagine being invisible. You could mess with someone's mind, sneak up on them, and they wouldn't know you're there. Even scare them to death. When you speed on our roads, that's what happens. Because no one sees you coming. Think Road Safety. A message from the Government of South Australia.
You're listening to Dirk Pullman on today's News Talk. TNT Radio.
And I'm talking to Pelle Neruut, who's working on a documentary about the murder of Dag Hammarskjöld. So what you found, that is really a new angle, is this negotiation where Berlin, Germany, was supposed to be a core point for a new peace proposal in the world. So what was the plan from Kennedy? What was the plan from Hammarskjöld?
Well, in the summer of 1961 was a very, very tense period because the East Germans were leading by the open borders of West Berlin, and the Khrushchev promised to recognize East Germany and hand over the border controls to the East Germans. And the East Germans were much more aggressive than the Russians, were expected to stop the West from entering West Berlin. And that would then a shooting war threatened because the NATO were not going to back down over sending their patrol, their troops into West Berlin by the open Autobahn convoys.
And there was a confrontation to just to support what you say, there was a confrontation with tanks at directly at the border, Checkpoint Charlie, I think it was, where it happened. Yeah.
So Berlin was the thing that occupied most of Kennedy's time and most of the news headlines. And how to solve this, because it was an unmovable force. I mean, the West wasn't going to back down. They were not going to hand over West Berlin to... Khrushchev said he'd turn it into a neutral city, get your troops out. And the Americans said no, you know. And so what were you going to do? How do you... Because it became such an important totem for both sides. Because the East Germany was, in a way, the Soviets' crown jewel, their symbol of the fact that they'd won World War II. World War II was basically won by the Soviets, with the West providing a supporting role, you know. And the Americans had supplied Berlin in 1948 with airlifts, and they said, no, we're going to keep Berlin. So how do you solve the Berlin question without turning into nuclear war? And the summer of 1941, Khrushchev had put a deadline on recognizing the GDR until November 61. And it, Kennedy announced on television, I think the 25th of July 1961, that he was going to mobilize and bring up the National Guard. And he'd commissioned the Hawks and his administration to come up with a graduated plan for forcing the Berlin Autobahns if the East Germans stopped them. And they, in the end, if they just stopped them, they would force a division through. And if they fired on that division, the Americans would eventually graduate to nuclear war. And at the same time, with an inner circle of doves in the Kennedy administration, he was talking about many things that became commonplace in the 1980s when Palmer was active. That is, a nuclear-free zone for Central Europe, a non-aggression pact with the Soviets, a withdrawal of NATO from West Germany. I mean, they'd still be a member of NATO, but there would be no troops there. And all those things that were later called Soviet propaganda when it was reignited in the 1980s. And mutual inspection and so on. And then West Berlin being turned into a neutral city with United Nations troops and maybe actually the UN headquarters being transferred to Berlin because the Russians said that, you know, America was a country of racist people, or that New York was a racist, ethnically divided city. So let's have it in Berlin instead, which is a destroyed city and could be a symbol of peace. And the week before Hammarskjöld died, this was on the discussion agenda of Kennedy. Kennedy written a top secret memo to his advisors to explore this possibility. So at the same time, another of his advisors had gone quite far with this disarmament proposal. You can Google it. It's called the McCloy-Zorin disarmament proposals. We don't know how far he would have gone with it. This was just a kite flying, with it's just one of many proposals. But in American diplomatic documents, this was the main plan if Khrushchev didn't back down. I mean, because anything is better. Kennedy actually said, well, you know, anything is better than nuclear war, even if we have to evacuate Berlin and turn it into a UN city. I don't care that much about it. But we could be sure that I haven't seen it in the documentation and I haven't seen it in the books that have been written about Hammarskjöld in the past, because many historians, I think, take a narrow view of just Hammarskjöld and Africa, which is a bit big, the place where he died and so on. And they didn't scope out and look at the big crisis of 1961, which is Berlin. If Hammarskjöld went down to Congo 3 days later, we know that Berlin and the UN, expansion of the UN's role and the change of headquarters must have been a huge thing on his mind, you know. And I haven't seen it in the I think that the only thing we can conclude is that some things were not put down on paper. Hammarskjöld had a very good relationship with the American Secretary of State Rusk and the American ambassador to the UN Stevenson, who was a kind of classic liberal progressive, and they must have talked these things back and forth. So the very fact that Kennedy might produce this as his mainstay of his peace drive, if to save the world from nuclear war, and this impossible to solve confrontation in Berlin, was to do something with the UN, which now, by then, Hammarskjöld, 8 years into the job, had created this fantastic reputation for himself, and he was going to step in and use that and become, I guess, the people who'd be against this, assuming that they knew. I don't know if he might have died just for narrow colonial reasons. That is, he was meddling in Africa against the colonialists, and he was killed by the colonialists, maybe under the control of MI6. But I don't. So maybe they weren't aware of the larger scale. But we know that, I think that Hammarskjöld undertook this risky trip because he needed to get the Soviets on board with the Berlin project, and he needed to show that he was not just a Western agent. And he needed to do it. He needed to sell out the British and the French to show the Soviets that they could do business with him. And he needed to show more and more issues were being decided in the UN General Assembly away from the Security Council. And the British and the French hated that because the Security Council was the source of their power. And they hated the way that Hammarskjöld brought more and more issues to the General Assembly where the great powers were outvoted. So
Hammarskjöld at the same time had to appeal to the third world countries or the non-aligned nations, with the UN as this kind of new global democracy, of where the UNGA, General Assembly, had as much more power than the Security Council. So he had to appeal to that, them as well. And the way he did that was to take an anti-colonialist stance in a way that openly offended the British and the French and the Belgians. But it stopped at such an early stage, this project, that we don't know how it could have played out. But I guess the dream one could have been was a better world with the imagination is the limit in a way. I mean, I'm a realist in the sense that I believe in global politics is always determined by power. Maybe we could have had a world where the UN was like a control rod in a nuclear power station. I mean, imagine if we had the UN today as Dag Hammarskjöld envisaged it in Ukraine, because him placing UN troops in a neutral zone created a sense of credibility, because that meant that big powers like the US and Russia facing each other in Ukraine can hand things over to the UN, and none of them feel that they've lost political face, and they could trust this organization not to shoot them in the back while they were retreating. And I think that if the UN is looking for a recovery of its role, I think a solution to the Hammarskjöld crisis, Hammarskjöld mystery, could be one way to put them back on track. Because I think the UN is the one hope for mankind now, in a world where we're almost staring down the barrel of nuclear war as we were in 1961, with the same powers in the same region of the world, and with some of the same things to play for, like resources. We've got, instead of Anglo-American colonialism, we've got globalism. We've got the same non-aligned, same African countries who are being played over for influence as we had back then. So in a way, I mean, what struck me about studying the Hammarskjöld period is how much it taught me about how the world still operates today behind the scenes, you know? Hello?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm listening to this. I think if I look at the situation right now, it seems to me worse than ever, because there's not even an idea of dealing differently with political stuff. It's simply power politics. It's a Machiavellian state. There's nobody on the horizon. I don't know anybody in the West who has who could be a new Hammarskjöld, who could be a new Kennedy, who could be similar to that. So, in a way, if we are not able to solve these murder cases that we have, like Kennedy and Hammarskjöld, I think it shows that, to some degree, that the West has come to an end in terms that it has nothing to offer to the world instead. A side of power politics. But what is your take on that? If you dove into that, and I know all these quotes about Hammarskjöld and Kofi Annan, who's talking about him, there's a ton of people who admire him, but there's nothing, you know, if you look into it, there will be nothing on Biden or Blinken that is on a similar scale, let's say 5% of that we read about Hammarskjöld. So where are we heading there? As a final comment, we have 3 minutes left.
Yeah. No, I can't see anyone either at all on the horizon. I mean, I obviously Hammarskjöld was a product of unusual circumstances. I think people who'd lived through the war, people who live through war don't want a repeat of it. And now today's young generation of politicians, they don't know a damn thing about anything. I think that Hammarskjöld was appointed because they didn't realize he was a stronger personality than he was. They thought he was a quiet little Swedish bureaucrat. And he was only the second or third choice. So we need, he came to power, he came into his position by accident, we could say. Because there was a deadlock in the Security Council and the French and the Soviets had vetoed other candidates. And then he had time to develop his credibility. And then you had a media culture that was favorable to him. And he was surfing with the times, modernism, and he had no baggage. And he became an icon. I mean, whatever his personal merits, he's very intelligent and said to be a very good organizer. The fact that people attributed credibility to him, he was like a house doctor. House doctors don't know very much necessarily, but people trust the house doctor and it makes them feel calm and it solves many of their problems. And so he was like a house doctor for the world. And I just don't see anyone on the horizon. I literally can't think of anyone who can play that role.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Pelin Root. And what is the title of your upcoming film? We haven't talked about that. So that's the final information out. What is the title of your upcoming film?
The Life and Death of Hammarskjöld.
Okay. Thank you very much for this very interesting talk. And maybe there are other instances where we have to talk, I think. But thank you for now.